Later today, we'll get the latest on the payroll tax cut, which our next guest says has to be extended so consumers have more money to spend. And while Democrats want to pay for the cuts by taxing income over $1 million, Republicans say don't tax the job creators, to which our guest says, phooey. James Livingston is a professor of history at Rutgers University. His new book is Against Thrift: Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. He believes we have to make a sea change in American thinking about consumerism, so let's get to it. Jim, start with what sounds like a political divide on breaks for business, but you say going back to Kennedy and Carter in the 70s, both political parties called for deregulation to stave off stagflation, that it's the political consensus that giving breaks to corporate America means they'll invest and create jobs.
The consensus runs even deeper than that, and it goes something like this. If we don't give incentives to private investment, private investors, they will withhold their money from investment. Therefore, they won't create jobs. Therefore, growth will not happen. What I do in the book is to try to, on historical grounds, not theoretical grounds, say that is bunk.
Well, you say more than that. You say it's, let's see, how can I do this for you? It's bull-doo-doo, it's pathetic,
yes.
It's dead
yes.
Wrong.
Yep.
Why? Because it would seem to make sense. You know, you give businesses breaks and then they plow that excess money back into
right.
The business. Why historically do you not see that?
Let's start in the present. From 1999 until our own time, another about 11, 12 years, the retained earnings of corporations have almost reached 8% of GDP. Why are these companies sitting on these huge piles of cash?
That's a lot of money they're holding on to.
Almost $2 trillion, that's right. Now, you could say they see too much risk, they're not investing. The historical evidence suggests, however, that private investment is simply not the essential component of growth. It's been declining, indeed atrophying, since about 1910.
So you're saying, you know, historically, companies do not reinvest, I guess is the better word, you know, take money that
right.
they make and put it back into growing their companies and growing jobs.
Right.
What do they do with it?
In the 1920s, what industrial corporations, not just banks, what industrial corporations did was to take their surpluses and loaned on call on their own account, that is to say in the stock market, to the tune of $8.7 billion between 1926 and 29. Now, why weren't they taking those surpluses, those profits, and reinvesting them? Because they didn't have to. Because they could increase productivity and output just by replacing and maintaining the capital stock. I'll give you one example. In the petroleum refining industry, between 1915 and 1925, all sorts of patents came online so that in the early to mid-1920s, you could build an oil refining plant for one-fourth of what it cost you in 1915. You could increase your output by 3 to 4 times.
And today, there would seem to be a corollary to that, which is that
yes.
American workers are working more hours than ever before. And if they're not spending, well, then why should companies reinvest in building more if they can get that much more work out of their workers with what they have?
Yeah. Greenspan, among others, has been complaining for about 10 years about why there's no fit between the extraordinary increases in productivity of labor and the increases in wages. In fact, wages and median family income have stagnated. Where do the productivity gains go? Well, it's pretty clear they go to CEO compensation and bonuses on Wall Street.
They go somewhere else, though. You alluded to it when you talked about where these companies put their money in the 20s. They go to things that create bubbles that burst.
Yes. When industrial corporations don't need to reinvest, when they can increase productivity and output just by replacement and maintenance, yeah, they turn their money over to bankers. That's why the financial sector has metastasized in the last 25 years, because of these surplus profits. Nobody knows what to do with them. So you hand them to the bankers, and the bankers look for the most profitable place to put them. Now, what that means in our time is speculative markets turning into bubbles. It's happened since 1983. Since the Reagan tax cuts, we have lived in a boom-bust cycle driven by speculative channels, by bubbles. And what we need to do, if we want to address that question, is to reverse the income distribution that the Reagan tax cuts inaugurated.
So just to be clear, the bubble in the 20s was the stock market. We saw that burst pretty big.
Right.
The
right.
bubbles more recently, housing, these bundled mortgages and things like that, because it wasn't being reinvested.
But because it couldn't be reinvested. I think that's the essential point. It's not that these people were actually making a choice about it. they had to put the money somewhere, and the highest return was going to be in a speculative
channel. Right. You don't build a factory and create jobs unless there's the demand for it. And that brings us to the demand. That's the end of the equation that you say the focus should be on. This is fascinating because there's so many factors here, and one of them is sort of almost a religion, an American fear of spending too much. You talk about how, you know, the country was formed on things like thrift and want and need, and that's how the American backbone was formed. And this idea of spending historically has been a problem.
Yes. You know, the Protestant work ethic, we're all victims of it. We don't have to be Protestants. We don't have to be Christians to know that it's good for us in building our character. All adults need to teach children that they can't have what they want right now, that they need to defer gratification. If they don't, they don't learn anything. My point in the book is that we have now reached a stage in human civilization where we don't have to do that. We can still teach our children to defer gratification, but insofar as we keep withholding economic resources and emotional resources from the present, from the here and now, we tend now to disfigure both the economy, the public purpose, and our characters, that is to say, the private purpose. Once upon a time, saving for a rainy day served that private purpose of building character. It doesn't any longer. So now we have to ask ourselves, what kind of personality might succeed the one constructed on that basis of deferral, delay, repression, and prohibition?
Well, hold on a second, because that sound you hear is my grandmother, you know, twirling. We also hear that we have an entire baby boomer generation getting ready to retire without any savings. Right. What shows you that consumer spending drives the economy as opposed to business?
Between 2008, GDP, the proportion of GDP on consumer spending went from 62 to 70%. And that seems to most economists and to most journalists, for that matter, to represent both an economic problem and a moral crisis. I'm suggesting that if private investment is unimportant to growth, then we need to not just get used to a greater proportion of GDP going to consumption, we need to get used to what goes with it. Consumer spending.
So you're saying that it's sort of a necessity, because if we've reached a point where we almost have the infrastructure that we need, then it has to be, instead of businesses building more and more and more, it has to be people buying more and more and more to, make it incumbent upon business to grow?
Yes. Then the question becomes how to get income into the hands of consumers so that investors, private and otherwise, might follow the demand curve.
But, Jim, you say that now corporate America isn't expanding, isn't reinvesting, isn't creating jobs. They're just investing surplus money in things like financial instruments?
And there, it seems to me, the key is the redistribution of income away from this silly idea that we need to reward investors by raising their profits so they can invest more. They don't invest more.
Okay, now you've said a dirty word. Redistribution.
Right.
That sounds like taking money away from people who work hard. I mean, this is how it's characterized, as you well know.
Right, sure.
Taking
sure.
money away from people who work hard and deserve what they've made and handing it to someone else. Define redistribution. What do you mean?
Since 1981, with Reagan's tax cuts, that's exactly what we've done, is redistribute income away from wages towards profits. And that wasn't a hidden agenda of Reaganomics. That was right out in front. What we have done for the last 30 years is redistribute income away from wages to profits in the hope that higher profits would lead to greater investment, more jobs, better growth. That's not how it worked. And so now what we should do is redistribute income the other way. We know that consumer demand drives growth. We know that investment follows the consumer curve demand. Why not then act upon that?
So you're saying the cuts have traditionally been to businesses, and you include in that easing regulations. And now, since that didn't work and they didn't grow the economy, most economists would agree that that's been the truth of, let's say, the Bush-era tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying let's do cuts that are more beneficial to the average consumer.
Absolutely. And let's reward productivity where it has actually taken place in the workforce. Not amongst the CEOs and not amongst the traders. What do they do? I mean, what are they producing?
But how do you do that? I mean, you say reward the worker. I'm presuming that one of the ways is higher wages. Corporate profits have gone up, 300%, and wages have stagnated. We've been hearing those.
Mm-hmm.
But right. How do you change that?
First, you ask yourself, what is this investment for? In other words, you're going to have to socialize investment. You can't leave it up to the profit motive.
Oh, how this to create is this jobs. Is, but in this climate, you just said you have to socialize
investment.
In this climate, how do you do that?
We already do it. We have socialized bank capital. Us taxpayers stand ready as the guarantors of every deposit in every bank. All right, that's what the FDIC is about. We are now the guarantors of bank capital because we bailed them out. About a half of the $2 trillion the banks are sitting on is our money. It's the bailout money. All right, so we've already socialized capital in that sense. Why shouldn't we participate in the allocation of that capital? To begin with, I think limits on bonuses and salaries, that would be fine with me. The other thing is, though, to ask what kind of jobs get created by what kind of investment. Why don't we ask ourselves, how can we participate in these decisions? In the final analysis, what the last 30 years have taught us is we've learned how to detach income from work, things like Social Security, food stamps. We do it, and we do it well, and we can do it a lot better, it seems to me. But on the other hand, we've watched as productive Americans have seen their wages stagnate and their jobs go overseas, even while the CEOs and the traders earn these fantastic incomes. There's no link between income and work on Wall Street, none. So we've taught ourselves in two different ways that we might as well move on with that and learn that we can be our brother's keeper. We have enough resources to do it. Why not go ahead and try?
Well, and the big answer to that is the political climate.
I'm not so sure that you're right about that. I think the left has made a cultural revolution over the last 25 to 30 years, and I think the right has used political means to block the effects of a cultural revolution that has made us much more egalitarian, much more invested in equality between races, between genders, and for that matter, between nations.
Well, polls show that most Americans do agree that there should be a tax levied against people with income and on the income higher than $1 million a year. So there's a disconnect
right.
between what Americans are saying and what politicians in Washington are saying. But just back to the spending thing for a second.
Sure.
This notion that, but that would be the right thing to do.
There is a very good argument against consumerism, and that is its excess. If it is excessive, if it is merely replacement when replacement is not needed, then of course we should worry about it. And of course, right now, we all have to worry about what's called deleveraging, getting rid of the debt that we did accumulate. In the absence of the redistribution I'm talking about, most of what I say can't make much sense. But in its presence, and I think the political climate is still conducive to it, we can begin to ask ourselves, what's better for us? Spending time and spending money, giving things to people that we love, using things that we cherish, handing things down to our children and our grandchildren. Is that better for our souls than accumulating assets that will ever accrue more interest? That is, what's better for us? Withholding from the present, whether emotionally or economically, or investing in it? And it seems to me we've never entertained the second possibility. We've never said, well, could that be better for us? And if there's one thing I hope the book raises as a question, it's just that. It's like, well, are we in a position to do that? And your question raises it, I think, rather pointedly. But if we are, if the evidence is on my side, the economic evidence, what then? How do we not recover from the Puritan ethic? And that's where you started. But how do we modify it? Or how do we contain its effects so that we can actually live in this moment, in this present, without withholding too many of our resources? Withhold some, of course, but without withholding too many.
James Livingston, professor of history at Rutgers University. His new book is Against Thrift, Why Consumer Culture is Good for the Economy, the Environment, and Your Soul. And we'll link you to his recent New York Times op-ed, It's Consumer Spending Stupid, at hereandnow.org. Jim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It was just great fun, Rob. Thank you.
Good.